morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program today, we're going to be speaking with Robert Knott, speaking of the arts. He's here just about every Friday. Right now, I'd like to welcome Sally Bingham. She is the author of many books, and her latest is called Red Car. It's a collection of short stories. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And you will be tonight at Garcia Street Books at 5 o'clock, doing kind of a book launch and reception of your new book. Now, you've written memoir, short stories, and novels. Tell us about the short story form and writing a short story and how it's different from other forms.
Well, I started out writing short stories really before I even knew what to call them as a child. And when I was in college and taking writing courses, I was working on short stories and began publishing short stories. I might really have stayed with that form because I love it, and a lot of the writers I admire are short story writers, but it's still true that if you start out writing short stories, publishers immediately begin to push you to write novels.
So, and what, that was because they just sell better?
Well, that was the theory. Nothing sells very well these days, so I don't know how true that is or ever was. So I advanced to writing novels and spent the middle part of my writing career writing novels and a memoir, and also began writing plays. It's only in the past 4 years that I've gone back to writing short stories. My last collection of short stories was 3 years ago, called Transgressions, then two novels, and then this collection of short stories.
And so it's sort of like you can't develop a whole long plot when you write a short story.
No, they're not particularly plot driven. They tend to be a more fragile form for the reader, because the reader has to understand the evocative nature of detail rather than being carried along by a plot, and also the subtleties of character development, which are very important in short stories. I think we're more attuned these days to reading both novels and long books of nonfiction than we are to reading short stories, which is a little odd because everyone's talking about our short attention span.
I know. Well, I suppose that if you're going to do escapism, you're going to do a longer form if you can, whether
you're
it be a three-hour
right.
novel, a three, a two, you know, two, three-hour movie, or like curling up in bed with your novel.
Yes, I don't think escapism works very well in a short form. You just can't get the setup in time.
Very interesting. So, how did you develop this set of stories? Do you sort of think, is there a theme that you're working with that goes from story to story, or set of themes?
No, there really isn't. The way this happened, when my publisher at Saraband Books asked me to give her some short stories because she wanted to do another collection, I just put together a huge pile of short stories. I have great faith in Sarah Gorham, my publisher and editor. And I said, I really don't know how to choose, and would you just choose the best of these? So that was her wonderfully eccentric choice, because she didn't choose any of the prize-winning stories, which I thought was great. She chose stories, some of which I've shopped around for years and haven't been able to find a publisher. So it's in that way of quite surprising collection. Quite surprising, which is fun for me, because they're not necessarily the stories I would have picked.
We're talking to Sally Bingham. Well, that's interesting, too, because it brings up the role of the editor, which we have heard in the sort of decline and fall of the publishing industry. Not that it's gone, but the role of the editor has been, from what I've heard, really, really truncated.
Yes, in the big commercial houses, it's almost gone. A lot of the editors have lost their jobs. And others are so overworked now that they really don't do any editing, and you're responsible for sending in a manuscript in the way you want it published, which can be hazardous for writers. We all need editors. Saraband Book has a staff of four, so small press, publishes probably 20 titles, and they focused on poetry and short stories. So they do very good overall editing and very good line editing. I've only found, so far in this book, one mistake, which is pretty astonishing. A name was wrong at one point. So I feel as though I'm in the hands of old-fashioned publishing in a lot of ways. They also have been great about finding French translations for my books, which mean a lot to me because I think my books really work well in French.
Well, some of the stories take place in France.
And some do, yeah. I lived in France as a child and have visited since, and the settings are very important in my stories, and I think some of the reasons why these stories may be a little baffling to people is that they do refer to words in French and French settings that may be pretty unfamiliar.
So you were a child in France. What were you doing there? What were your parents doing there?
My father was working for the Marshall Plan after World War II, and he was a journalist. It was his one foray away from journalism in the South, and he wanted to take all his five children, so we all went willy-nilly. I had never been out of Kentucky before, so it was quite an astonishing transition, and the only school available to me was a French-speaking convent school, and my mother told me I'd have to somehow not only learn French, but also pretend to be a Roman Catholic, which I did.
Which children can pretty much do.
Yes.
They can pretend to be anything. There's a story about a little girl around, I guess it was really set around the time that you were small there in France.
Yes.
And that sort of part of it is just about the process of acquiring language, a new language.
Yes, I'm fascinated by that. I think it opens up our minds in a way nothing else does. There's often an imperceptible moment when you understand your first words in another language. You hardly even know you have understood them until you reflect on it. And then the next step is the more terrifying step of actually speaking a few words.
Which, when you're small enough, isn't even terrifying because you don't think about it.
No, and you don't worry about your accent as much as we adults do.
What was it like? Do you remember, I mean, there's sort of the hint of the political dimension, but do you remember that from being a small child? I mean, sometimes children are pretty much immune from politics.
Well, at that time on the Normandy coast, which is where we were, there were many remnants of the invasion. Including things like army boots on the beach and barbed wire, and the German bunkers were still in place. I had no idea, really, of what that war had been like in Europe. I knew a little bit about what it had been like in this country. So it was actually the graphic images of what had happened on those beaches that brought it home to me.
And then there's always that perception of what do these things really mean?
Exactly. In fact, when the little girl finds a boot on the beach, she thinks maybe it was pulled off by the waves until she sees that the side has been torn out, and then she realizes it wasn't the waves, it was something else. And there was once somebody's foot in that boot. And children in this country have, especially before television, very little exposure to what it actually means to be invaded, the kind of suffering that produces. So if for this little girl who's led a fairly sheltered life, it's almost unbelievable that a whole country could have suffered in that way.
We're talking to Sally Bingham. The book is called Red Car. Would you like to read a story or part of a story?
Yes, I'd love to. I'll read a few pages from the title story, which is called Red Car. Car may not be the word. Automobile is long outdated, and car seems to be going or to have already gone the same way. Although it is perhaps still appropriate for this particular vehicle, a red 59 Cadillac convertible with a front seat wider than a porch swing, a cumbersome white top, and the makings of history in its various grills, bumpers, fins, and chrome ornaments. To tell the story of this car is to tell the story of marriage, not their marriage, not the marriage, but marriage as it generally happens. A state, a place, a condition that gives rise to certain thoughts and attitudes, certain conclusions. Marriage equals the red car. March. The red car has been parked for a year in front of a pretty frame house in Florida. It sits at the curb like a claim, loud and clear, to the pretty frame house, an exclamation point in that quiet neighborhood. The wife rode in the car for the last time in March. She had eaten dinner with her husband in a restaurant they visited on the way back from the airport, on the way to the airport, and often in between, a lively little place with a bar overlooking the ocean. They both dreaded going back to the house. There's a silence particular to the end of a marriage when there are no words, not even any actions, to convey the despair, the listlessness of the approaching end, and the broad white bed in the big bedroom is no longer even a hope or a possibility, but another item on an endless list of disappointments and regrets. So when he said, "Shall we take a drive?" she thought it was a good idea to put off that end. They drove out along the bay where the houseboats are snubbed up against the highway and the lights from the strip developments waver in oily darkness. He pulled her in under his arm and drove with his left hand, and she wondered why once again she was allowing him to drive her when he was drunk, and why once again their past seemed to have returned. The one-handed driver, the broad seat, the woman shivering in a light cotton dress under the heavy arm of a man to whom she appears, against all reason, to belong. They stopped to look out over the water for a while, as a few months later they would stop in an overgrown field to look for the last time at a pair of circling hawks. The power that held them in the palm of its hand arranged these last times carefully. The beautiful golden field leading to massed sycamores at the edge of the creek, the beautiful expanse of the Atlantic at the edge of the built-up town. Last times have a certain weight, a smallness and density. They stay in memory like pebbles at the bottom of a child's pail.
Sally Bingham. And the book is called Red Car. It's a book of short stories, and Sally Bingham will be at Garcia Street Books in Santa Fe at 5 o'clock this afternoon. So I was thinking in that story, you chose not to name the characters.
Yes.
Why?
Well, because they're really icons. They have almost no individuality at all. And I think that's often true when you get into dramatic situations like divorces. People tend to lose their individual characteristics and become icons. I'm sure we've all had that experience from time to time. You represent something rather than being something. And it's both terrifying and sort of interesting to see the way individual characteristics drop away in the great maelstrom of those events.
Meaning you behave out of sort of patterned,
yes.
Societal patterned responses.
Yes. People have often remarked how very genteel, nice people turn into absolute savages in the middle of a divorce, tear each other to pieces.
Or in the middle of traffic.
And that's always lurking there, that icon. In that case, a rather dark icon. There are other kinds of icons, too, probably having to do with romantic love.
There's one story in which a man is keeping a diary and finds out that a woman has read the diary.
The big no.
And I thought, isn't that funny? Because usually, it's sort of a reverse of the usual setup. You know, the girl is the one who keeps a diary about her romantic life or whatever, and the guy might or might not read it. But this is the other way around.
Yes, and I like that story particularly because it's set in the 70s, and I think that was when I felt the real force of feminism, and of course so did many other people, including men. And some men, I think, tried consciously to adopt the kind of development that women have always used diaries for. And so it is a reversal of roles, and in fact the woman who reads his diary is the critic, whereas in the more traditional sense it might be the woman writing the diary and the man who reads it and is the critic.
Right. Well, that's interesting, too, because I was thinking as I was reading some of the stories about what the role of feminism is in your life and in your writing.
It's very much tied up with what I think is the sadness of many women's lives. Sadness for many reasons, beginning with terrible economic struggles. As we know, many women are working two and even three jobs. Lack of any child care, lack of any affordable health insurance, the sort of basic level of sadness that comes from the struggle to survive, and then on top of that, the struggle to have our voices heard and taken seriously. There have been some changes in that, but not as many as I would have expected when I started out in the movement 30 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't think there's been that much change?
Well, you may be an example of the change.
I don't know. I mean,
I think the biggest change that I've seen, oddly enough maybe, is the presence of women in sports and the fact that women's sports are taken so much more seriously now. People actually go to see college basketball teams where in the old days they could hardly attract an audience. if the teams were women.
Well, isn't there also, like, law, science, and medicine?
Yes, but when those women, and the, as you know, those graduate departments are now more women than men. But often when those women graduate and go on into the workforce, they meet some of the same kind of problems that we all met trying to get into the professions in the 70s.